In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about the United States Supreme Court, looking a little bit at its present and its past, and perhaps speculating on its future. Scholars and journalists and other people who follow the court believe that it is very likely that in the next few years, there will be a significant turnover in the court's makeup. Earlier this fall, the court announced that the Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, had cancer, and that led to a lot of speculation that he might soon retire. Also, attention has been focused on several other members of the court and the possibility that over the next couple of years they might decide to retire. And that would give President Bush the opportunity to name as many as four members, new members to the court, something that hasn't, no president since Richard Nixon has had an opportunity like that. And that certainly would give Mr. Bush the chance to shape the character of the high court for a long time to come. This morning in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the court with David Garrow. He is Presidential Distinguished Professor at the Emory University School of Law, where he teaches civil rights litigation and reproductive rights. He has written on both those subjects, including several books about Dr. Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, including Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. That was a book that received the Pulitzer Prize back in 1986. He's also written a good deal about the Supreme Court, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. We always welcome that. We simply ask people, though, that if you would like to be involved in the conversation, you just try and be brief in your comments so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible. If you'd like to call here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, so if you would be long-distance call for you, use that number, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Garrow, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Certainly.
Perhaps first we might talk a little bit about Mr. Rehnquist. It has been the tradition for a long, long time for the court not to give out a lot of detail about the private lives of the justices. But as people certainly will know, earlier this fall, the court announced that Mr. Rehnquist was ill. He was receiving aggressive treatment for cancer. That led to a lot of speculation about his condition, whether he would be able to continue, and whether he might be compelled to step down sometime soon. Now, I think just recently he has said that he intends to administer the oath of office when Mr. Bush begins his second term next year. But I think people still are wondering about what exactly his future is. What is known about his condition?
It's a very puzzling situation at present. The Chief Justice has now missed two full months of oral arguments, both the November sitting and the just-completed December seating. The most unusual thing just the other day was the announcement, in contradiction to what the court had said earlier, that the Chief Justice will not be casting votes in all of the cases that he missed, but will only be voting in cases where the other justices come out in a 4-4 tie. Now, that seems to suggest that the Chief Justice is too ill or too tired and drained from his medical treatments to be able to read all of the briefs and transcripts in the roughly 12 cases they hear each month. There are further questions or complexities because inescapably the Chief Justice would be casting his vote from home without having had the benefit of actually being present for the group discussion of all nine justices.
How long can the court continue like this with one member unable to fully perform his duties?
It's a very difficult call whether it's better for them to stumble forward in this situation as opposed to having a vacancy occur during the middle of the court's term. The court's year runs on roughly a sort of academic academic year from early October till the end of June. Any of us who've had the opportunity over the years to talk privately with one or another justice about this sort of a situation, we know quite well that the justices feel very strongly that the court always should be at full strength to avoid the possibility of a tie. And so I think it's a very safe assumption concerning the Chief Justice that he would think that if he's able to stay alive and remain functioning through till the end of June, that might be the best thing for the court, even if he's not going to be physically present. The next really crucial date actually comes 10 days before President Bush's re-inauguration on January 10th, which is when the court begins its 2 weeks of hearing cases in the month of January.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately, then, it is up to the individual justice whether he or she believes that they are capable of carrying out their duties?
Unfortunately, that's exactly the situation, that given how the Constitution provides for life appointments to the court, and given the tremendous amount of independence and deference to individual justices that exist even within the court itself, it's a pretty safe bet that not even any of the other justices would ever bring themselves to say, sorry, Chief, it might be better if you thought about stepping aside.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the past, where we've had justices who weren't simply suffering from illnesses, but were clearly starting to have their mental acuity slip a little bit. Unfortunately, the historical record shows us that even in those situations, more often than not, justices stay on too long.
Well, as I mentioned, there always has been this very long tradition that the activities of the court and the private lives of the justices are closed to the outside world as much as that's possible. And I know that you were quoted in a story that appeared in the Washington Post last month raising some questions about that, at least in the respect that we would not tolerate that level of secrecy about the life of the president, about our representatives in Congress, about an awful lot of people who have posts in government, and yet we do that for the court, perhaps because there has this been longstanding tradition of the idea that somehow the court was supposed to be insulated from political pressure, and as part of that, we seem to draw the curtain over the lives of the justices. Do you think that is good, bad, or indifferent?
I think we've clearly allowed things to go too far in the direction of the court being almost a sort of semi-sovereign group of royalty. If we think, for example, about how much detail we've seen in the past, every time Vice President Dick Cheney has gone into the hospital to have his heart looked at. Just a few weeks ago, Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, who's being named Secretary of State, went into the hospital for, I gather, a rather routine gynecological process. The news coverage of her situation told us maybe a little bit more than we actually needed to know. In contrast with the Chief Justice, we've been told virtually nothing. None of the press coverage has even had the benefit of speaking to any of his doctors, not even knowing who they are. And we've really received no reports about his condition, about his treatment, about his prognosis. the contrast to Ms. Rice and Vice President Cheney is pretty stark. The justices very much enjoy being public officials who nonetheless remain somewhat private figures. A good number of them enjoy being able to go out in Washington or go out in Boston or New York and not have everyone on the sidewalk recognize them. And so there's a very strong, deep reluctance on the part of the court to become any more forthcoming with the American people, whether about medical conditions or most anything else.
When people talk about the justices who, in addition to Mr. Rehnquist because of his health, who might be expected to retire over the next few years, it seems that the attention focuses on three: Sandra Day O'Connor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and John Paul Stevens. Mr. Stevens is the oldest member of the court. He's 84. Sandra Day O'Connor is 74. Ms. Ginsburg is 71, and both of them have had some health problems. So I guess it's sort of a combination of their health and their age that focuses the attention on them. Do you think that, in fact, it is likely that if there is some turnover in the court within the next few years, certainly within the time that President Bush is in his second term, that these are the members that might, you know, barring other unforeseen circumstances, might be the ones who would choose to retire?
Just given the age distribution we have on the court today, Clarence Thomas is the only one of the nine justices who's younger than 65 years old. It seems almost inescapable that we probably will have at least one more vacancy in addition to Chief Justice Rehnquist sometime in the next 3 or 4 years. But it really bears emphasizing that in the present day, being a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court can be a very cushy part-time job. The court nowadays is actually hearing argument in only about 80 cases a year. As I touched on a little bit earlier, they really sit and hear cases only 6 days a month from October through April. And a good many of the justices do a fair amount of their work from home. Justice Stevens, in fact, is well known for spending a good portion of time in Florida. Notwithstanding the fact that Justice Stevens is 84, that Justice O'Connor, Justice Ginsburg are both in their 70s, especially for individuals who just greatly enjoy continuing to serve on the court, it's not at all likely, so long as they remain in good health, and it seems relative to their ages that they really all are in quite good health. It's certainly quite possible that even 4 years from now, Justice Stevens, Justice O'Connor, individually might still be there. Mm.
Just let me ask you one further question. I have somebody who a caller who has been patiently waiting, and I want to make sure they know I won't make them wait forever. But maybe just one further question: if Mr. Rehnquist steps down, President Bush could either he could select, and definitely correct me if I'm wrong about this, he could select one of the current members of the court to be the Chief Justice, or he could name someone completely new and bring them in to be the Chief Justice. Do you think one or the other of those approaches is more likely?
I think most of us who follow the court very closely believe it's much more likely there will be a new Chief Justice from outside rather than a promotion from within. Justice O'Connor would certainly be one internal possibility. But her age is such that she'd be unlikely to serve as Chief Justice for the better part of a decade or more, And I think many people would feel that it was sort of poor form to promote someone to Chief Justice who might likely serve only 3, 4, 5 years. The other possibility that some people talk about, which I find a little difficult to imagine, though I think we have to acknowledge that it is a possibility, is promoting Justice Thomas, mm-hmm. Who's extremely well thought of in conservative Republican circles, and who I think, frankly, is finally beginning to receive a modicum of the respect from academic commentators that his originality as a justice deserves. But it's, at least for me, difficult to imagine that Justice Thomas and his family would want to go through another confirmation process.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Garrow. He is an historian of the United States Supreme Court. He is presidential distinguished professor at Emory University School of Law in Atlanta. He's on leave at the moment, but he's on the faculty at Emory and has written about the court and has also written about civil rights, the civil rights movement in the United States. And questions here are welcome as we talk about the Supreme Court. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have that toll-free line, 800-222-9455. We have a caller listening over in Danville this morning. We'll go there to our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I wonder if your guest would speak a bit about the privileges and responsibilities of the Chief Justice as distinct from those of the Associate Justices in the Court?
Well, excellent question. Professor Garrow?
Certainly. The Chief Justice's role is much, much closer to simply being the first among equals rather than being any sort of elevated figure. Indeed, what's most special and distinct about the position really concerns the administrative side of the job in overseeing the what's called the Judicial Conference of the United States, which is the sort of administrative supervisory group of federal judges who oversee and set rules for all of the lower federal courts. Inside the Supreme Court itself, the two substantive responsibilities that the Chief Justice bears by tradition, not by any constitutional provision or statute, are, number one, presiding at the justices' private deliberations about cases, about which cases to hear, and the authority with cases that have been argued to assign who's to write the primary opinion for whichever side, majority or minority, the Chief Justice happens to be on. Now, needless to say, for this past 2 months, Chief Justice Rehnquist has not been presiding at the conferences. That role has fallen to Justice Stevens, who's second in seniority. But presumably the Chief may, we don't know for sure, may still be exercising his authority in assigning opinions.
When we think about the balance, liberal conservative of the court, and what might be likely to happen if certain members decided to leave, if you look, for example, at the case of Mr. Rehnquist, if he retires and is replaced by a conservative, that's not going to change anything. The focus is on these other members that we talked about, both because they're the ones that are likely to go, but also because if they are replaced by conservatives or people who are more conservative than they, that is going to change things. Justice Ginsburg regularly votes in the minority, so that would certainly be a significant change. Justice Stevens, although he was appointed by Gerald Ford, is not considered to be one of an extreme conservative, at least in the range of opinion on the court. And Justice O'Connor, she is the one that in many cases is important because she can go either way. So if let us say, Mr. Rehnquist leaves and he is replaced, and one of these other three leaves and is replaced by someone who is more conservative than they and someone who is perhaps more in the mold of Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas, how dramatically might that change the court and the way that it would make decisions?
The possibility of any dramatic change is actually far lower than a lot of interest group mass mailings, both liberal and conservative, often lead many people to assume. Perhaps the most commonly discussed hot button type of issues, abortion and gay rights, this court, as a practical matter, is really split 6-3, not 5-4. Similarly, on affirmative action, the basic lineup is 6-3. On gender discrimination, it's more likely 7-2 or even possibly 8-1. The area where this court has been most radical and most closely divided, 5-4, concerns a whole series of federalism cases dealing with congressional legislative authority over state government functions. Now, this is a set of cases that law professors for the last 10 years have found highly fascinating, but they're not cases that the average American is going to find terribly dramatic or terribly interesting. Mm. So even though I think many people think of this court as being a capital C conservative court, I would instead say that while it's been quite a conservative court on federalism and some economic and business questions, that when we look at gay rights, abortion, gender discrimination, affirmative action, it's actually been in almost every particular instance somewhat surprisingly liberal.
Mm. Well, and one of the things that I have read is that people also should, in thinking about what it means if one or two or more new members are named and that they're conservative, what that means for the way the court will look at some of these hot button issues, have also read that among conservatives, there is also a tendency to have respect for and to be disinclined to overturn precedent. So that doesn't necessarily mean that if you have somebody who is very conservative coming into the court, that they are immediately going to want to change, to overturn what prior courts have done.
That's very much the case, and probably most explicitly so with abortion. When the court back in 1992 reaffirmed Roe v. Wade in a case called Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the controlling opinion there, which was jointly written by Justices O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter, made it very clear that at least two of those three are personally quite anti-abortion, but it quite forcefully insisted that what was at issue here was not individual justices' views of abortion, but really the institutional dependability and reputation and stature of the court. And so both with these present justices and with many, though not all, of the possible nominees that President Bush might put forward in the next few years, it's not simply a question of what are someone's personal feelings about abortion or gay rights, but the institutional responsibilities that one inherits for keeping the Supreme Court as an institution to be a sort of reliable, consistent, rather than politically erratic body. Now, it's in this context where Justice Thomas is the most original and the most radical of the justices, because he's quite willing to envision going back 60 or 70 years in time and throwing a lot of things out the window.
We are a little bit past our midpoint. Again, I just wanted to introduce very quickly our guest for this hour, David Garrow. He's professor of law at Emory University. That's in Atlanta, Georgia. He teaches civil rights litigation and reproductive rights, has written on those topics. He's also written on the civil rights movement and written a number of books about Martin Luther King and the movement, including one that won the Pulitzer Prize. He is talking with us this morning by telephone, and we're talking about the Supreme Court, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. I think we're getting ready to get another caller lined up here. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about that I think is interesting, again, this has to do with the history of the court, something that I learned from reading an article that you authored for the publication American History, is that there has been, and you take a look at the court and its makeup and who it is that has been named to the court, that relatively recently there has been a major change in the kind of individuals that presidents were selecting for court membership, and that what that means for the court and how it operates, from a point where people were, in a sense, more people who come from the world of politics, and in fact, sometimes people who don't have experience as a judge of any kind, to a time when we're drawing on people who are judges, who are appellate judges, and who are a different kind of person altogether, perhaps because they haven't really been involved in politics. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Certainly. For over 30 years now, really dating back to Chief Justice Rehnquist when he first joined the court in 1972, ever since Chief Justice Rehnquist's appointment, every justice who's been named to the court has been a sitting appellate judge, usually a federal judge, or in Sandra Day O'Connor's case, a state court judge. Before 1970, however, especially back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, the norm was not to promote career judges, but to name public political figures, U.S. senators, governors, cabinet members to the court. Now, those were individuals who would arrive at the Supreme Court without any prior experience in how to be an appellate judge, but they were all people with significant political experience in the wider world. The last Supreme Court justice who really falls in that category of having been a prominent public figure prior to joining the court was Thurgood Marshall. When President Johnson named him in 1967. And so looking back over 50 or 60 years, we've gone from a court that featured public figures like Earl Warren, who had been governor of California, Republican governor of California when he was named, Hugo Black, senator from Alabama, and a number of less distinguished former members of the Senate, to this current pattern where it's really a court of career judges, some of whom also have been legal academics, and so it's a quite radical contrast when one looks at the longer history.
Hmm. Well, then, when you look at these two major kinds of courts, depending upon their makeup, the differences in their makeup, then you look at the decisions that they've made. Can you see a kind of a personality or a kind of a legal temperament that's different because of who these people are and what they did before they arrived at the court?
What a good number of us who follow the court think is happening, has happened, especially this last 10 years, is that the Rehnquist court's very assertive, some would say sort of self-assertive, self-regarding, self-important behavior relative to Congress's legislative authority, that this pattern is indeed a reflection of career judges, both conservative and quote-unquote liberal, concluding that they know best rather than being more deferential to legislative bodies, especially the Congress.
We have another caller to talk with. Let's do that. Someone here in Urbana, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, there are two areas I was hoping I could get some comment on, and one has to do with your concentration or focus when it comes to the Supreme Court, and it's in reference to a book a couple years ago by a professor from American University called Raskin. I don't know how to pronounce his first name. I think it's Jamin.
Yeah, Jamie Raskin, yes, who's written on voting rights.
Yeah, and he wrote a book called Overruling Democracy, and one of his contentions is that that the country began as a slave republic of Christian white male property owners over the age of 21, and that we've expanded and deepened democracy only through political struggle and constitutional amendment, and that the Supreme Court has been quite reactionary most of the time, except for the Warren Court. But the one thing that he argues that I wanted to run by you is that he argues that the one person, one vote rule has been attacked in this Supreme Court. And then I have another area I wanted to ask you about, but I thought I'd ask you that one first. I was wondering what's your feeling about that.
Baker v. Carr, which was the first of the one person, one vote decisions in 1962, was always the case that Earl Warren himself, when people asked him what was the most important thing the court did during his time as Chief Justice, he always selected Baker, the one-person, one-vote case, rather than, say, Brown versus Board of Education or Miranda or any of the sort of more popularly well-known cases. The court has remained pretty consistent on that one-person, one-vote set of precedents over the years. Where the court has had probably the biggest recent difficulty and where they're really almost visibly treading water has to do with partisan gerrymanders of congressional and legislative districts. We've seen a lot of coverage the last year or two about that taking place in Texas, in Colorado, in Pennsylvania. And the court has been very reluctant to intervene and rule against excessive partisan bad behavior, even when the facts of individual cases could look pretty egregious to someone, depending on their own political preferences. And to some extent, the court's reluctance to take a forceful position in that arena is the result of the experience it's had over the last 30 years with racial gerrymandering and districting, where the court has ended up sort of pulled hither and yon between different theories of what's the fairest representational approach for African American voters, particularly in the South.
But you would still contend that you would say they haven't strayed very far from the one person, one vote.
No, not at all. The question, in which this doesn't really divide on a liberal conservative line, is whether the one person, one vote cases should require them to intervene in a clear, forceful way when we see the sort of heavy-handed partisan districting that, for example, has recently occurred in Texas.
Yeah, well, I think most progressives would say, you know, they would like the court to intervene. But anyway, the second question I was wondering is about was that, as I understand it, treaties have been given short shrift ever since, and I believe the word, the beginning of that trend was with our experience with the Indians and our expansion west, and since that treaties in the Constitution are supposed to be up there as supreme law of the land, along with you know, our other laws, etc., you know, on an equal footing, but it seems that because of our history about treaties, you know, the court has ignored that, and since it has a real import as to things like NAFTA and the war in Iraq, how would you characterize the Supreme Court's attitude toward treaties in general? And I'll hang
sure.
up and listen, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
The constitutional status of international treaties remains pretty much unchanged over the last 30 or 35 years. And indeed, the sort of reigning precedent on treaty cases remains a migratory Byrd Act decision from the 1930s concerning a treaty with Canada, a case called Missouri v. Holland. Now, in this current court, there is a quite visible tension, though at the moment it's more a rhetorical tension than one of competing actual decisions or rulings, between some justices, Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy, perhaps most openly, who believe that the U.S. Supreme Court should openly work to inform its own decisions by reference to constitutional courts in other countries, whether Canada, Europe, etc. In contrast, perhaps unsurprisingly, Justice Scalia is the most dismissive of that idea, and Justice Scalia takes what I think one could fairly call a pretty explicitly nationalist attitude that American courts should not, say, for example, on the death penalty, compare U.S. Laws to developing or evolving international standards. This is probably a tension that'll become more pronounced in the years ahead.
We are moving into our last 15 minutes in this first hour of the show, talking about the Supreme Court with David Garrow. He is Presidential Distinguished Professor at Emory University School of Law in Atlanta, has written about civil rights litigation, reproductive rights, teaches on those subjects, has also written about the civil rights movement, and we're talking, as I said, we're talking about the Supreme Court. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. In the time that remains, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the debate that's been going on for some time now, the conversation about how it is, what it is that judges are supposed to do and how it is they're supposed to go about carrying out their duties. And make reference to some of the things, for example, that President Bush has said about the kind of people that he has appointed and would appoint. He said, for example, in one of the presidential debates, he was asked about what sort of individual he would select for the Supreme Court. And the president said this. He said, quote, "I would pick people that would be strict constructionists. We've got plenty of lawmakers in Washington, D.C. Legislators make law. Judges interpret the Constitution. And that's the kind of judge I'm going to put in there." So I'd like to talk a little bit about activism, constructionist approach to the law. There, first of all, I guess there is this clear implication that somehow conservatives tend to be constructionists. That is, they interpret the law as it's written, and that's that. They don't bring their personal opinions into it. They don't bring politics into it. They don't bring public opinion. They don't bring anything. They just interpret based on what's sitting there on the page. And also the accompanying implication is that the activists, they're liberals, and that's the way that this breaks down. Is that in fact true?
Let me sort of sketch it this way. Mm. I think almost all of us who are careful students of the court, irrespective of our own personal political feelings, would say that this present court has 9 activists. Period. Whether it's John Paul Stevens, whether it's Stephen Breyer, whether it's Clarence Thomas. Strict constructionist, for listeners who are old enough to remember it, really was first popularized by Richard Nixon in 1968-1969 when campaigning against the Warren Court, and particularly the Warren Court's criminal procedure decisions, was a major theme in President Nixon's 1968 election campaign. Now, Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, and I said a little bit of about Justice Thomas a few moments ago, they are certainly conservative, but they are by no means advocates of judicial restraint. Indeed, what's most fascinating about Justice Thomas, more strongly than Scalia, is how much of American constitutional law he's quite willing to re-examine and reconstitute and throw out the back window. Where we really see the most tension is between justices who attempt to set down clear, explicit rules that prospectively would control a good-sized range of prospective future cases, and justices who, on the other hand, decide things very narrowly, very fact-specific, very case-specific. Now, I think there's almost unanimous agreement that on this present court, Justice O'Connor is the narrowest of the justices, someone who takes a quite visible pleasure in deciding cases as specifically and as precisely as possible. In contrast, perhaps Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia, though in very different ways, would be at the opposite end of that spectrum.
Well, just one further point real quick, and that is I guess I'm interested again on some sort of historical perspective about on this issue and whether, in fact, how common it has been over the years for, and say we'll just stick with the Supreme Court, for justices to indeed bring to their decisions their personal opinions, some feeling about what public opinion is, some appreciation for or allowance for the political tenor of the times. Is it really possible for one to not include any of that in making one's decisions?
My response to that question would be a very simple no. Even Hugo Black, probably the most dramatic example in the last 60 or 65 years of a Supreme Court justice who, sort of in the Scalia style, though Black was always categorized as a liberal, not a conservative, but even for someone like Justice Black, who insisted that he was simply literally interpreting and applying the Constitution, it nonetheless is very clear in retrospect, particularly in cases involving civil rights demonstrations and student protests, that Justice Black's approach to defining constitutional terms was inevitably influenced, and influenced quite significantly, by what he personally felt about what was taking place at that time in the United States. And I think that where we really see variation is more in the frankness or the honesty with which justices acknowledge being influenced, as opposed to insisting that they're not being influenced. Hmm.
We have just a couple of minutes left. We have two callers. I'm afraid I can't get them both, but I'll try to get one at least. Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Your guest mentioned the current Supreme Court practice of determining constitution, determining constitutionality on the basis of foreign law. I don't know whether you favor this foreign law determination or not, but what possible justification can there be for deciding what our American Constitution means by what any foreign law says?
I think the answer that someone like Justice Kennedy or Justice O'Connor would give would be, particularly with reference to Great Britain, also somewhat less so with reference to the Western Europe, the European Union, that so much of American law and culture and tradition traces back across the Atlantic to Europe, that particularly with Britain and with Europe more inclusively, that we should pay attention to what courts there are doing. There's been increasing social contact between the U.S. Supreme Court and justices on other courts, West German, Canadian, Japan, etc. And as we've seen more U.S. involvement the last 25 or 30 years in helping new countries write their own constitutions, as has recently taken place in Afghanistan, I think it's the view of a majority of today's justices that we should sort of reach out rather than set ourselves apart as a wholly separate legal island.
In other words, the Constitution is just infinitely flexible. You can just pick any criterion that you please to, and it just insert it into the Constitution?
No, I don't think that Kennedy or O'Connor would agree with that at all. But I think, to use a recent example, what should American constitutional law be on capital punishment for minors? or capital punishment for the mentally retarded. Now, very few justices would say that there is any clear, explicit command in the Constitution with regard to what the Eighth Amendment's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment gives as an answer in either of those circumstances. That's the sort of context in which O'Connor and Kennedy, in essence, would say we should look, acknowledge, pay attention, not necessarily follow, but acknowledge how have these questions been answered elsewhere among countries we respect.
There we must stop because we've come to the end of the time for this first hour of the program. Our guest, David Garrow, he is Presidential Distinguished Professor at the Emory University School of Law in Atlanta, now on leave from the post, but nonetheless a faculty member there at Emory, has written a good deal on the history of the Supreme Court, on issues of reproductive rights, and also on civil rights. And Professor Garrow, we want to say thank you very, very much for spending some time with us today.
Certainly, it's been a pleasure.